From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. If you're a student or a parent, you might be familiar with the stress of college admissions tests. We'll hear from one educator who's concerned that those tests distract from learning. A recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling is prompting a change in the way North Carolina taxes trusts. You'll learn why. The U.S. attorney based in Raleigh has concerns about local sheriffs who refuse to cooperate with federal immigration agents. He explains the consequences of sheriffs ignoring detainer requests for immigrants charged with crimes. And we'll look ahead to North Carolina's next legislative session, and even further ahead to next year when a significant number of current lawmakers are set to leave. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
So what do Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus and the state of North Carolina have in common? Well, believe it or not, they do have something in common. Both organizations have been the proud owners of a 9-car train, complete with a Greatest Show on Earth insignia slapped on the side. No, we are not kidding about this. We do know that North Carolina now owns a circus train. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins us now to talk about this really incredible story broken by Carolina Journal. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Okay, so why does the state of North Carolina own a circus train?
Because the people inside the State Department of Transportation believe that this particular train, which the state bought when Ringling Brothers went out of business 3 years ago, can be refurbished into a passenger train, passenger cars for a passenger train.
Nine cars, right?
Nine cars. That's right. There's no engines. There's no locomotive, but these, it's up for refurbishing. Now, the question, as Don Carrington was out there reporting the story and looking at the train, he calls into question whether or not it's actually going to be worth refurbishing by the time anybody gets around to it. Because as far as we can tell, the plans for doing so are not immediate. And the train itself, the cars are starting to get dilapidated. I mean, some of the windows have been broken out and covered with plywood. The metal itself is getting rusty. I mean, it's not exactly what you would call your classic turnkey operation when it comes to refurbishing a train.
So, Rick, where is this train sitting?
Just outside the town of Spring Hope. It's on the term abandoned rail line draws the ire of some people in the rail business, because actually you can conceivably still use this little spur to do things like store trains that are no longer in use, as with our circus train
here. So it's actually on a train track.
It's on a train track, but the track itself is not really used for anything right now. It hasn't been for some time. And that's typically what happens, as it turns out, when someone purchases an out-of-service train or portion of a train that it intends to use later on. It will put it in an area that doesn't have any active traffic, so they don't have to move it constantly. But it's sort of hidden in the woods, and we got a tip about it, and Don was actually able to look on Google Earth and see, yes, there's a train out in the woods
in Nash County.
And so he went out and took some photos of it and started asking some questions and did the story.
And by the way, the story and this incredible pictures of this train are available at carolinajournal.com. I would encourage everyone who hasn't yet seen this to go onto the website, carolinajournal.com. And I suspect if you put into the search box circus train,
that'll get it.
It's going to come up and you can see the picture of this. And you're right, Rick, when I'm looking at the pictures of it, I mean, you do see the Greatest Show on Earth placard that has been on the side, is kind of like peeled off, and there is plywood. So it looks like it's in terrible condition. Now, you said that DOT says they may want to convert it into some sort of operational train.
Right.
Do we have any idea, like, where where they might see that train actually going to and from, or what the use would be?
I mean, the Department of Transportation does is involved with some passenger train operations. For one thing, it could indeed contract and lease with, say, Amtrak or some other passenger train system. They spent nearly $400,000 for these 9 cars. But again,
that's taxpayer money that went out for this.
That's right. That's taxpayer money. But again, as far as we can tell, there are no immediate plans to do this. There are, again, there are issues of, well, is it more expensive to purchase new rail cars if you're going to have a passenger train system than it is to refurbish old ones? Well, this will be a good test case of whether or not that is true.
I have been reading stories over the last months about what apparently is a very, very interesting hobby, almost. I'll use that term, by people who have some money to spare and who like to ride on trains, and they go out and buy these things themselves, and then they, I guess, hook onto Amtrak at some points,
right,
and they're able to go across the country where they want to go on their private car. But I never really thought of it as something that state government would get involved in. Do you recall when they bought this? Was it
That was right after Ringling Brothers went out of business in 2017. It was bought right after Governor Cooper took office, in fact. And the thing about it is, yeah, we don't really know exactly when they're going to use it, where they plan to use it. They just have it. They say, well, we need the excess stock in case we want to operate passenger lines. But again, North Carolina also owns a railroad, and we've done stories about the North Carolina Railroad. So it owns a railroad company, and now it owns a train. It doesn't own an engine, as far as we can tell. So they're getting
unless
there.
Unless it's sitting somewhere, and we just don't know yet.
We're getting there, though. We'll eventually have a real live train we can actually use.
Well, it's a great story reported on by Don Carrington of Carolina Journal. Again, it's all available, including those really interesting photos at carolinajournal.com. And Rick, I think this story, which has really caught on, other news media now reporting on this after CJ broke this story, it's a really good example of the type of really good reporting work and investigative work. This happens to be kind of a half fun, half serious story, but it is taxpayer money, and this is important for people to know. But Carolina Journal does have great reporters, does get tips that other news organizations don't, and follows up on them. And in fact, now, Carolina Journal is the recipient of numerous additional awards now from the North Carolina Press Association. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
You happen to be one of the award winners. Tell us about it.
That's correct. Well, a few years back, the Press Association started acknowledging the fact that there were publications that produced most of their content online rather than in print or in broadcast. And the Press Association doesn't really handle broadcast media at all, but it does, it has focused on print, and it started opening an online division for publications like ours. We do a paper product, but most of the material we do is online.
Print edition is monthly.
That's
but
right.
Daily news cycle.
And so we do that. And so they opened up a separate set of awards for online publications, and we began entering that 3 years ago, and each of the 3 years we've been winners. And we won 7 awards this time, which is actually combined is as many as we've won in the previous 2 years. We're very pleased with the fact that we got a couple of first prizes. I got it for editorials for the 3rd straight year.
You can say it. I know you're
okay.
A little bit hesitant to
humble
teach
brag
your
here,
horn, but go ahead.
but for editorials for the 3rd straight year, but also very pleased with the reporting awards. One of them was a separate category that Duke University sponsors on higher education reporting, and Carrie Travis and Lindsay Marcello won that award for their work about general transparency failures inside the UNC system. They've both been reporting about this, everything from issues with the Board of Governors to the Silent Sam problems and things like that. And so they got first place in that, and I think that's a really nice feather in the cap for us to have won that. We also, Lindsay got second place award for education reporting for a story that she did about the 25th anniversary of the Leandro lawsuit. And then she also got second place, and we're really proud of this, for her accounting of the budget veto override in the House on September 11th, because everybody was reporting on that. And in fact, the judges mentioned as much that this was a story in which there were a lot of of entities that placed entries in there, and she got second place in that. So we're very, very proud of that.
And Julie Havlak and John Trump also getting awards.
They also got second place. John for his columns about various topics, and then Julie for hers about a series of stories she did dealing with people who qualify for Medicaid in North Carolina and can't get there because of the bureaucracy. And so, again, a wide range of stories, and we're just proud of everybody.
So reporting and also commentary, winning awards from the team at Carolina Journal. All of that work available at carolinajournal.com. Make sure that you can take advantage of this award-winning, rigorous journalism. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you have a child in college or a child getting close to going to college, you've probably dealt with the prospect of admissions tests, the ACT or SAT. Well, our next guest wrote a recent column for Real Clear Education with this headline, "College Admissions Tests Hinder Meaningful Education, But They Don't Have to." Our guest is Tyler Bonin. He is a high school teacher at Thales Academy in Raleigh and also an education fellow with Young Voices. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, everyone who's ever had to deal with college, whether you are the student yourself or the parent, has had to think about the prospect of taking the ACT, the SAT, or both. It can become very stressful. And in your piece, you focus on the fact that it's not just stressful, it actually takes away from meaningful education for these high school students. How so?
So the process of studying for the SAT, the ACT, of trying to up your score has become a very stressful event for many students. The SAT and the ACT has gained a lot of attention recently for two things. One is because of the sort of arms race that many top-tier colleges are engaging in. Ever since U.S. News and World Report became the source for rankings and the source for parents and students who are looking at colleges, it's just become this competition in terms of always gaining that increase in average SAT and ACT scores among students. And so there's this huge impetus among families to really spend a lot of time engaging with this. Recently, it was even in the news in California, as several civil liberties groups have threatened to file a lawsuit against the University of California system, citing the fact that the SAT is inherently discriminatory because you have those families who have the resources to hire outside tutoring, to hire a lot of help for the SAT versus those students who are in underserved schools and whatnot, right? But beyond that, though, the recent changes to the SAT, and this was done at the behest of David Coleman, who's the newer CEO of College Board, who develops and administers the SAT, has aligned the SAT with Common Core, of which he was also the chief architect. And so what you've seen with the SAT, and the ACT tracks along as well, because it also attempts to align with Common Core, is a move away from those traditional texts those traditional elements of education to a sort of data-based, informational-based test. So, for instance, in Common Core, by the time kids are in eighth grade, over half of what they read needs to be informational in nature. And by the time they graduate high school, the requirements have it so that nearly 75% of what students read are informational texts. And so that doesn't leave any room for sort of the great works, the great literary works, philosophical works that we know to have been sort of the pinnacle of a traditional education.
And so we're talking about reading something like a how-to magazine article or instructions for putting something together rather than reading Plato or Dante's Inferno or something like that. Is that what we're talking about?
That's true. That and, you know, works that might be sort of journalistic works. And of course, they have value in our society. Journalists are very important, but it doesn't present them with the opportunity to really push the boundaries of the way that they think about things as you mentioned before, a philosophical work would had they had to read, say, Kant or Aristotle or something like this.
So this is something that's tied into now the ACT and the SAT. One of the interesting things about your piece at Real Clear Education is the fact that there's another test out there that actually offers an alternative, and you suggest a better one. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so the new test that I was referring to is the Classic Learning Test, known as the CLT. It's an acronym. And that test has been around for a while now. It started with a few schools accepting it, as well as institutes within a school. For instance, Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism also takes this test. They work with a lot of the great books in a program that's focused on the moral foundations of a free market economy. So they use that. They were using that test to gauge applications coming in. But now you're looking at over 170 colleges that are accepting this test. And the basis of this test is that it's focused on the great books and prominent historical figures of the United States. And so I mentioned in the article, you know, you're looking at a test that's going to include passages from, you know, Aristotle to Archimedes to Susan B. Anthony, Booker T. Washington, and others. And so it's giving a new life to what it means to engage with the great works and great conversation.
From your vantage point, why is that so important to not just have the basic skills of reading a journalistic article, but to have engaged in these great books and have learned about historical figures who are important?
Well, to be honest, that's sort of the bigger conversation, the bigger debate that's being had in education now. We are fundamentally built on these works, right? We came from the Western tradition, and these works are fundamental to understanding that tradition. To really engage with history at a deep level, to understand where we are today, you have to engage with the important conversations across time. It means more than simply analysis of a text. It's important to know how to read, but it's also important to know how to read between the lines, how to think at a deeper level and to think critically. And sometimes when you're just engaging with a student, asking them to simply restate the main idea of a passage, and it's a journalistic passage, that's important. You need to know how to read, but it's not really getting at the root of what it is to mean to truly learn, to engage at a much deeper level with ideas that are sometimes really hard to grapple with.
As an educator who's dealt with high school students, do you see a difference when you have the students who are focused on, I got to do something that's going to help me on the SAT versus, you know, I'm engaging in these books. I'm engaging in these great ideas that have come down through the ages.
I do. I really do. It's a hard sell at first. I think that's, again, part of the nature of education today. Of course, I teach at a classical academy, so we're trying to get back to the root of true learning. These notions of truth, beauty, and goodness, right? But I think what happens, though, is that when you keep everything at a surface level, you have the, for instance, you have grades as a sole exogenous motivator. It's always about doing what you need to do to achieve the grade or to achieve the score. And so you're going through, I see sometimes students fall in this trap of going through the process, not to better themselves, not to grapple with an idea and come to a better understanding, not to seek the truth necessarily, but just to seek that grade. I think Common Core and the SAT sort of exacerbates that notion of having this outside motivating force instead of trying to engage with the great works that help to build the motivation force from within, the motivation force to learn and to understand your world better.
These are very interesting issues. Once again, the article, which you can find at Real Clear Education, is titled College Admissions Tests Hinder Meaningful Education, But They Don't Have to. Its author is Tyler Bonin. He is a high school teacher at Thales Academy in Raleigh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A recent U.S. Supreme Court case is forcing some changes in the way North Carolina taxes trusts. In the so-called Kastner case, the nation's highest court ruled that North Carolina could not tax an out-of-state trust solely because the trust's main beneficiary lives here. In the wake of that case, the State Revenue Department is dealing with roughly 500 requests for tax refunds. During a recent meeting, legislative staffer Greg Roney explained some of the issues the department and legislators could consider.
Trusts certainly are used a lot for tax planning. They're also used for like family planning. But again, right now, your basis of taxation is either the assets physically here or the beneficiary split physically here. And then now the court has said, well, it takes the beneficiary physically here plus more. And so, you know, it's a pretty, you're not anywhere close to the limits of what you could tax. So you are already right now under your current law, or if you did nothing, you're still on the lower end of where you could tax. I mean, because we're not taxing the trustee, we're not taxing the trust office. We're only looking for that beneficiary, and the court said, well, beneficiary alone is not enough. It takes beneficiary plus more. And so it's the plus more that's a little vague.
Republican State Senator Paul Newton had questions about the steps his colleagues and the Revenue Department might take moving forward.
Have you made a determination whether you need legislative relief going forward? Or, I mean, it sounded to me like you have changed sort of how you're going to tax trusts as a basis of this case, and you're going to narrowly define the case, appropriately so. But do you think you have the tools you need going forward, or do you know today whether you're going to ask us to enhance the legislation around this?
We are internally considering whether legislation is appropriate. We've got some draft legislation that we're considering, but we've not finalized that.
I just want to ask you, to ask staff, that if legislation is required for you to close what gaps you think are remaining in properly taxing trust beneficiaries, that there be some good analysis about potential unintended consequences of that, to follow up on Senator Heiss's notion that, you know, trusts are developed to avoid taxes. This is why they exist. So if we suddenly tax more heavily, what's to prevent the trust and the beneficiaries and the trust from just going to another jurisdiction that taxes with a lighter touch? So I would want a lot of insight into that before we vote on something that will increase taxes on beneficiaries and trusts.
That's State Senator Paul Newton. He's sharing his concerns about North Carolina's possible response to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling against the state. The so-called Kastner case deals with taxation of trusts. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The U.S. attorney based in Raleigh recently targeted North Carolina sheriffs who refused to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. Robert Higdon shared his concerns about those sheriffs during a news conference.
When Americans think of the work that ICE agents do, they focus on the country's actual physical borders, the border to our south with Mexico, the border to the north with Canada. But of course, that is only a part of what ICE does and where they serve. Enforcement of our immigration laws, which are key to the safety and security of every American, take place throughout the country, including right here in the Eastern District. On a daily basis, ICE agents deal with individuals who are present in the Eastern District illegally. They investigate immigration violations by individuals that they find, locate the offenders, and then handle those cases in either immigration court or in criminal court as necessary. My office, working with ICE and other agents of the Department of Homeland Security, regularly prosecutes violations of federal immigration law. Those prosecutions, in general, target individuals who are here illegally and who have been previously deported and or who are engaged in other criminal activity. Even a cursory review of our press announcements over the last 2 years or so show that those types of cases, as we do our part to ensure that the country's immigration laws are respected and honored. Unfortunately, in the last year or so, we have found the work of enforcing the immigration laws all across North Carolina to be more difficult, as some of our key law enforcement partners have refused to cooperate with ICE by declining to honor detainers.
What is a detainer?
A detainer is essentially a notification from ICE informing the sheriff holding an individual that there are sufficient facts to believe that the individual is present in the United States in violation of immigration laws and is subject to deportation with the detainer. And the detainer is asking the sheriff to hold that individual, an individual, again, who is already in custody, for a short period of time until ICE agents can take custody of that individual and present him or her to an immigration court for determination of their status. It is a simple process which has served us well for decades, for the entire time that I've been a federal prosecutor, and which allows for the proper enforcement of the immigration laws while focusing on criminal offenders and doing so in the safest and most low-key way available to us.
Higdon says conditions have changed.
In the last year or so, the Wake County Sheriff's Office has declined to honor ICE detainers on more than 200 occasions and has released individuals ICE officials have determined are present in the United States in violation of federal immigration laws. This is a growing problem across the state as several of our sheriffs in the largest communities in our state have declined to cooperate with ICE in this regard. That has left us with very few options as we seek to enforce the immigration laws on behalf of the people of this federal district. It has left us with a single course of action. ICE agents have been required to go out into the community, investigate the whereabouts of these individuals who only recently were in sheriff's custody, locate them, and arrest them. This increases the risk of danger to the investigating and arresting agents, increases the risk of danger to the community in which the offender is found, and increases the cost and strain on an already burdened law enforcement system that is tasked with enforcing our immigration laws.
Raleigh-based U.S. Attorney Robert Higdon discussed ICE's response to the sheriff's recent actions.
Over the course of the last week, ICE officials here in North Carolina have been working to find and arrest many of the individuals who have been released by the sheriffs in these larger counties who have declined to cooperate with ICE. ICE conducts targeted enforcement activities on a daily basis and will continue to do so going forward. The most recent operation targeted at-large criminal aliens who have been identified based upon encounters, that is, arrests, with local law enforcement.
What were the results?
The Raleigh area ICE team made 16 arrests of foreign nationals with a variety of criminal arrests and convictions in their background, including driving while intoxicated, burglary, assault on a child, robbery, drug possession, and resisting a public officer. One individual has been confirmed to be a member of a transnational criminal street gang, Sereno 13. Of those arrested by ICE, 8 were previously deported and are now pending federal prosecution for violations of Title 8 United States Code Section 1326, which is reentry of a removed alien. 7 of those 8 have now been charged here in the Eastern District, and 1 has been charged in the Middle District of North Carolina. Additionally, 4 of the individuals arrested were identified as here illegally while in the custody of the Wake County Sheriff's Office. 1 was released despite a detainer having been placed on that subject and in spite of charges involving the assault of 2 children ages 3 and 6. 3 were released before ICE could respond.
Higdon highlighted specific examples.
Jose Montiel Martinez is a citizen and national of El Salvador. He was convicted of felonious breaking and entering of a building and felonious larceny here in Wake County back in 2013. In November of 2013, he was ordered to be deported by a United States immigration judge. He was at that time warned of the penalties of reentering the United States without permission. He was found in the United States during this enforcement operation and has now been charged by criminal complaint in this district. Francisco Javier Contreras Villaverde is a citizen and national of Mexico. Back in June of 2000, he was convicted in Harris County, Texas, of aggravated robbery and sentenced to 7 years imprisonment in the Texas Department of Corrections. In April of 2005, he was ordered deported to Mexico and was warned of the penalties of reentering the United States. He was found in the Eastern District as part of this operation this past week and has now been charged by criminal complaint in this district. Luis Gerardo Aguilar Soto is a citizen of Mexico. In March of 2010, Mr. Aguilar Soto was arrested in Johnston County, North Carolina, for DWI. Ultimately, he was ordered deported in June of that year. He was later found in Sierra Blanca, Texas, in September of 2010, and was again deported to Mexico in January of 2011. On November 3, 2018, Mr. Aguilar Soto was arrested by local authorities in Johnston County and was charged with DWI and driving while license revoked. He was fingerprinted at the time of his arrest, and a search of ICE and FBI databases resulted in a positive match and confirmed him as a previously deported alien. He was unfortunately released before ICE could lodge a detainer, and he had been at large since then. Of course, as with any indictment, please keep in mind that the individuals charged are presumed innocent, and that it will be my office's burden to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We look forward to that opportunity in federal court.
Higdon, the Raleigh-based U.S. attorney, praised federal immigration and customs enforcement agents.
I want to thank the men and women of ICE for the critical work they do and for the incredibly professional manner in which they do that work. They risk their lives and safety every day to ensure our security. We owe them a deep debt of gratitude. Our announcement today is designed to highlight the fact that by refusing to honor ICE detainers, some, and I stress only some, of our law enforcement partners, the sheriffs who have declined to honor ICE detainers, have made the difficult work of our ICE partners much more so. And I'm asking those sheriffs to reconsider their position and to honor those detainers and help us to properly and efficiently enforce the country's immigration laws and to ensure the safety of the people in our communities. We will keep working hard to bring those offenders to justice. We're simply asking for help in getting that job done.
That's U.S. Attorney Robert Higdon. He's defending federal immigration and customs enforcement agents, and he's chastising North Carolina sheriffs who refuse to cooperate with ICE agents. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. About two dozen state lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, that's about 15% of the General Assembly or so, well, they are retiring from office. So that means after the November election, there will be quite a few new faces over at the state legislature and potentially some new outlooks on policies as well. Becky Gray, who's Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation, will be getting to know all of the new members after the election. She joins us now to talk about what could be ahead. Becky, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So two dozen people, that sounds on the one hand like a lot of people, but is it really?
Well, you know, out of 170 total lawmakers that we have in the General Assembly, we always have a turnover. You know, there are people that retire for whatever reason. There are people that, after the primary, we're going to see too, because there may be some who are defeated in the primary
right.
that don't come back. I mean, what we just know now is who has filed and who hasn't. This is not out of the ordinary, not one way or the other. You know, is this an outlier in what we usually see? You know, we always have folks who have been long-term serving in the General Assembly that move on, and with them go some real historical knowledge and background and, you know, that. So this is how it goes. It's an ebb and flow kind of thing. Don, I tell you, a couple things that I have found interesting this year, though, is there are a number of lawmakers who are giving up their seats in the General Assembly to run for other offices. We have a couple of House members that are running for open Senate seats. And then we also have a number of lawmakers that are running for governor, lieutenant governor, superintendent of public instruction. I mean, you know, there are other offices that some of these folks are running for. So although they're leaving the General Assembly, they're taking their knowledge and experience from the General Assembly and perhaps going to serve in other offices across North Carolina. So that is the thing that struck out to me in this of maybe a little bit unusual. One other thing, too, that I found interesting is there are a number of Republican members, former members of the House, who are coming back to run for their seats again. And one Democrat in the Senate, I think it is Alan Wellens, who is from Johnston County, who served in that body years ago, is running again for that seat. So there's always a transition and there's always an ebb and flow. The numbers are not what is interesting to me this year. It's where those people are going and where their other interest is.
A lot of moving parts there. That's kind of interesting. So on the one hand, when it comes to the General Assembly, there will be some loss of institutional knowledge and background and history of how things have worked, what policy issues and proposals have come up before, perhaps. But on the other hand, you're going to get some new ideas, some new thinking, and also people who need to ramp up on all of that knowledge that other people have. One of the ways they do that, of course, is to rely on organizations like the John Locke Foundation. And you actually run a program that helps legislators, no matter their political party, no matter their ideology, get up to speed on things.
Right, and we've been doing this since 2008, so it's a very well-established program that we have, and this is open to all candidates, regardless of what their political affiliation may be, or even the particular race that they're running for. It's geared mostly towards legislative races, but we also work with a lot of Council of State races and congressional candidates. Anybody who is interested in good, solid, well-researched conservative policies, we are the go-to source. And Donna, you know, I've been, this year has another kind of outlier. I think we've had more participants just this far in the election cycle this year than we have in the past. So I think that's good news. I think it's good news for the Locke Foundation, but I think it's also good news for North Carolina that people are very interested in these kind of policies and the information that we're able to provide.
So you're helping to get those folks educated, informed about public policy as they look towards running for office. And then those that are actually elected in November, boy, they're going to have a lot of information they'll need to know. And of course, you'll be over there at the legislature literally day in and day out talking with folks, helping them understand the questions on
right.
the table.
Yeah. I mean, this public policy in North Carolina state government is complicated and there's a lot of pieces to it. And I think one of the things that I've really been encouraged to, again, people from all different parties want to be informed. They want to know. They want the facts. They want the data. They want to be able to understand, to process, and then to articulate what their views are on these very important issues, whether it's taxes and budget, whether it's reining in the growth of government, whether it's regulation, whether it's health care, education, legal issues, property rights, you name it. People have been very responsive to what we have to offer. And I think that's good news, again, for the Locke Foundation, for the candidates, but also for the people of North Carolina.
And helping those candidates and then elected officials understand the impact on real people of the votes that they will make as members of the General
Assembly.
Exactly.
And, you know, as you mentioned, too, our interaction and our efforts don't end when Election Day is over. In a lot of ways, we're just getting started then as a resource for lawmakers throughout each two-year biennium. And in some cases, you know, because we've been doing this since 2008, there are sitting legislators that we worked with when they were just thinking about running for public office. And so, you know, you have that value of a long relationship and also the consistency of the policies and the ideas that we have and are able to articulate and provide that good, solid information for folks.
It'll be after November of 2020, then, that we find out what the established and elected makeup of the General Assembly will be and who those new people are and who those veterans are that you'll be working with going forward. But before we get to that, Becky, we've got actually a short session of the current General Assembly that will be back in Raleigh in April. And I know you've already got your list together of what you hope to be talking with people about. Let's start and talk about criminal law reform. That has been a real high priority on your list, and the legislature has started to take some action. What is it, first of all?
Yeah, well, you know, Donna, we've seen these transformational reforms in North Carolina with our tax system, with the way that we look at state government budget, the size of state government and how all that is put together, infrastructure, the way we fund education, the way that we make investments in infrastructure. And so this criminal law reform is kind of the next big piece of the reforms that North Carolina can do. And what we're talking about is looking at our criminal law system. We have criminal statutes that, of course, are in those volumes of law books. They're actually scattered throughout all of those volumes of the general statutes. But in in addition to that, we have all kinds of criminal violations through state agencies. We also have all kinds of criminal violations that are put into place by local governments, municipalities and counties, boards and commissions, all kinds of things. And it is a big mishmash of stuff. There is no way that a regular person can understand and figure out all of those criminal law violations. Now, obviously, you know, things like, you know, rape and murder and larceny and battery and all of those kind of things, of course. But what we have is a lot of criminal activities that have been declared criminal activities that are, in many cases, being a burden for people to start businesses. You know, imagine if you were that you want to start, you know, your own business. You've invested your money, you get underway with that, and you begin to realize, gee, if I go askance of the law here, I could be convicted of a crime
and you
for
might
doing
not even
some
know
of these
it.
Things. And probably don't would not even know it. So imagine the chilling effect that that has on people that, you know, may want to start their own business. And it just, you know, lots of overlap. Occupational licensing can have criminal convictions associated with it. So what this reform is talking about is going up and cleaning that up, looking for duplication, looking at, you know, in North Carolina, we have 17 different laws about larceny. Why is that, you know, scattered wow. all across the books? I mean, why don't we have one law that says in North Carolina, it's against the law to steal stuff, you know, rather than all these others? And yeah, I mean, we'll kind of make light of it a little bit, but it really has been, it has had a real chilling effect on people. And so this whole criminal law reform notion is to go in, clean it up, and then recodify what our laws are. And then go forward from that. And with that, once we get that all cleaned up, then some of the other criminal justice reforms that we've talked about will kind of take care of themselves.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the Locke Foundation. Becky, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.